Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:33 p.m. on Thursday, February 12, 2022. And present today, we've got Representative Allard, Representative Stapp, Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Representative Schrage, Co-Chair Schrage, Representative Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Jimmy, Representative Galvin, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And did you have a question, Representative Bynum?
No, sir.
Oh, okay. I thought you had a technical something, maybe.
Oh, no, sir. But, okay. Maybe you're going to let me take over today. I don't know. No chance.
Before we start, folks could please mute your cell phones. We do have one bill before us today, and that's the continuation of House Bill 284. That's the governor's omnibus tax bill. The bill was introduced last week, and we made it through the first section, which is the sales tax portion. The Department of Revenue has returned today to finish walking the committee through the rest of the bill. We have the entire committee time to finish this presentation. So we do also have with us Representative Tomaszewski as well as Representative Hannon. And we'll jump right into it. If we could have up at the table Commissioner Janelle Earls, Administrative Services Director as well for the Department of Revenue, and also Brandon Spanos, Acting Tax Director, Department of Revenue, and finally Dan Stickle, Chief Economist, Department of Revenue. And thank you so very much for joining us again. If you could put yourselves on the record and... We do have a fairly dense slide deck, so if maybe we could hold questions until after this next section on, I believe it's the corporate tax portion, if we could hold questions until the end of that, and then we'll go to questions, and then we'll go to the next section. If folks could hold questions during the presentation, and then we'll take questions after that next section. And then I think there are other two other sections in there. That was the fiscal notes section, if anyone had any questions on that, if we have time. And then I think we're doing a pretty good job of hitting the high points on the bill, but I know that there is a sectional analysis, and if there are questions there, happy to jump into that. But I think we'll probably be okay. So with that, if there are no questions in the committee, Acting Commissioner Earls, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Chair Foster and members of the committee. We are here to again for House Bill 284. For the record, Janelle Earls, Acting Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, and with me is Acting Director Brandon Spanos and Chief Economist Dan Stickle, and I will actually turn it directly over to them today to slide 18 to talk about corporate income tax.
Thank you, Commissioner. For the record, Acting Director Brandon Spanos with the Department of Revenue Tax Division. And I'm going to go ahead and start with the corporate income tax slides, and then I'll pass the mic over to Dan Stickle, who will go over the next section with the oil and gas changes in the governor's bill. And then we can tag team the fiscal note, or Dan can go over that. We're going to start here on slide 19, which is just there are basically two changes to the corporate income tax proposed in this bill. And the first is to modernize the sourcing rules and then to take the rate down to zero in 2031. So moving on to slide 20, this slide provided... Sorry, my mic seems to be cutting in and out. It provides some history for the corporate income tax, and it is a little lengthy, but I think it helps kind of set the stage on where we're at today and then what the changes are going forward or what are being proposed in the bill. So first, the tax itself dates or predates statehood. It goes back to 1949. The tax rate was 10% of federal tax liability for individuals and businesses. And then the Uniform Division of Income Tax Purposes Act, or UDTPA, was drafted and approved by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws in an attempt to bring uniformity to all of the various states. That was in 1959, and it required apportionment of the tax rather than just taking a percent of federal tax. In 1970, Alaska adopted that the Multi-State Tax Commission's compact, which is a restatement of UDTPA with some minor changes. It established standard three-factor apportionment of property, payroll, and sales, which we use today, which is basically how Alaska determines what slice of the pie we get, how much of that, how much of a company's income is apportionable to Alaska. In 1975, Alaska's tax was repealed and re-implemented with major revisions. We adopted the Internal Revenue Code by reference. So basically, instead of defining the entire income tax in state law, we piggyback off the federal tax code. And that helps to make things clearer to taxpayers and not have different codes throughout the U.S. in each state. Alaska rates was 5.4% plus 4% of a surtax based on Alaska taxable income, not federal tax liability. This method of tacking our statutes to the federal statute is a rolling conformity as opposed to a static conformity. Some states do a static conformity, which basically means that they're attaching their definitions to a specific state and time, or a time for federal changes, like some of our depreciation is tied to federal code in 1981. Which would be static, but otherwise, if the federal government makes changes to their tax code, ours is automatically changed, which is the rolling conformity. We had other major changes come in 1978 through 81. Alaska was flush with oil money, debate over how to tax oil companies and share wealth with people. In 1978, we enacted separate accounting on oil and gas corporations, still just for C-Corps. It was the apportionment that we were talking about earlier. And it was did not apply to S-Corps or other pass-throughs. In 1980, Alaska had a lot of oil money and repealed the individual income tax, and that's how the pass-through companies were being taxed. So companies that are either S-corporations, partnerships, individuals, or other non-C-corporations do not pay tax on their corporate income, or on their income, rather, in Alaska. Separate accounting was repealed, effective in January 1st of 1982, and set up current worldwide apportionment, which is what we currently have today for oil and gas companies, with a 9.4% top rate. There was legal challenge to the separate accounting, which the state ultimately prevailed in 1985 in the Supreme Court, but the state kept the apportionment methodology for oil and gas companies. In 2014, our current tax brackets of 9.4 top rate remained and now applies to income over $222,000 versus previously it was $90,000. Sorry, I should have skipped forward a slide on the second portion of that. I'm sorry, that was all on the one slide. I saw the 222 there at the end, which I just mentioned. So moving on to slide 21, looking at the current tax situation, generally Alaska follows the Internal Revenue Code when determining an entity's tax status. Alaska has no personal income tax. The state's corporate income tax applies only to C-corporations, and for non-petroleum corporations, corporate income tax is based on water's edge activity, or basically the United States activity within the U.S., which means we add up all the income for all affiliated entities in the U.S., and then we apportion based on property, payroll, and sales. And that's their property, payroll, and sales in Alaska over their property, payroll, and sales everywhere. Our corporate income tax for oil and gas is based on worldwide income. So they have slightly different apportionment factors. It's property production and sales plus tariffs. So that's their property in Alaska over their property worldwide, their production in Alaska over their production worldwide, and their sales plus tariffs in Alaska over sales plus tariffs worldwide, divided by 3, that gets you apportionment. We apply that to their income, and that's their taxable income, their apportioned income to Alaska. Several tax brackets, the top rate is 9.4% for Alaska. And that, again, is taxable on income over $222,000. And the next slide shows those brackets. So this is the brackets for all of the C corporations. The there are several brackets with a top rate of 9.4, which is the fourth highest in the U.S. currently. Moving on to slide 23 is basically the change that's proposed in this bill. When we talk about modernizing the corporate income tax, we're talking about moving from what we currently have for apportionment of, sourcing of sales. So when we talked about those three factors, property, payroll, and sales, how those sales are sourced or where they're sourced to is what we currently use something called cost of performance, and we look at where is the cost center for those sales. So if you're a streaming service, your cost center is probably not in Alaska. So wherever that you're headquartered or your main cost center is, you're going to source your sales to that state, and your sales in Alaska could be zero. So a lot of states have looked at that old methodology that made sense back in an age when sales across borders were usually mail order, and there weren't very many of them, and they were that we use that cost of performance to source because a lot of the costs for mail order were significant in other states, and that seemed fair at the time. Most states have now moved to market-based sourcing, and rather than looking at where your cost center is, they look at where your market is. So a lot of companies are taking advantage of marketing to Alaskans, and we feel that it is important then that their market is reflected in their sales. And so rather than looking at where your costs are, we look at where your customers are, and the sales are then sourced there. So rather than having a zero in your sales numerator on your apportionment schedule, you would have whatever your customer base is for sales in your numerator, which then, of course, creates a slice of the pie, whereas you might not have any slice of the pie under the cost of performance method. So that is what's proposed in this bill to modernize the sourcing rules. Moving on to slide 24, market-based sourcing would, as I mentioned, modernize corporate income tax and capture sales that are currently reported to other states. This is an approach that acknowledges the realities of today's modern world and how goods and services are often bought and sold online. The cost of performance model no longer makes sense as a sourcing rule to the states. This proposal does not include a separate carve-out for highly digitized business, but a market-based sourcing approach in this bill would nonetheless capture the sales of highly digitized businesses when their customers are in Alaska. So if a business that is considered highly digital is currently reporting zero sales to Alaska under market-based sourcing, they would have to report what their actual market is and their what they sold to their customers in Alaska. So they would be included they would be taxed under this bill, just not under a single sales factor. Moving on to slide 25. The revenue impact of this change is estimated to be $15 million per year, and that is a midpoint in a range of possibilities. There would be winners and losers under this approach. So which companies would be paying more under this approach? Multi-state corporations in technology, professional services, finance, transportation, and e-commerce businesses delivering goods and services into Alaska. And these are primarily lower 48 companies with little or no physical presence in Alaska. Which companies would be paying less under this approach? These would be companies with a physical presence in Alaska, but with few Alaska customers. And so they have Alaska property and payroll, but most of their products are being shipped out of state. And then for companies that are solely in Alaska and their customers are solely in Alaska, there would be no change to them. Moving to slide 26, the bill proposes to reduce the tax rate to zero in 2031. The governor believes that having a lower corporate income tax rate will increase investment in Alaska. As I mentioned earlier, currently Alaska is the fourth highest corporate income tax in the nation at the 9.4% rate. By reducing the rate to zero, he believes that that we would be more competitive for C corporations looking to invest in Alaska. This is consistent with the governor's desire to increase business in open Alaska to other new business. And that brings us to the end of the corporate income tax section of the bill.
Great. Thank you very much. I've got a question, and we'll go to Representative Hannon and Galvin, Bynum, and Stapp. Did I miss anyone? And so my question, Mr. Spanos, is this section adds a digital online tax to our tax system. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, it doesn't add a digital tax. What it does is it captures sales that aren't currently being captured in the numerator.
Okay. And so my question is, recently the governor had vetoed the Digital Compact bill. Is what this is doing very similar to what that bill did? And if not, can you explain why? I think just to help the public, I mean us as well, but certainly I think the public, you know, saw, you know, it was a very, it was definitely out in the news when that veto was held. And so I'm just thinking that people are probably wondering, you know, how do we reconcile these two things? So can you speak to that?
Sure. So that bill did two things, really. It does exactly what is proposed in this bill. So it changes the sourcing from cost of performance to market-based sourcing, and that's most of what SB 113 was, which is the bill that the governor vetoed. And when I say most of the pages of the bill were for the changes to market-based sourcing. Then there was just one section of that bill that also changed the apportionment methodology for what was titled highly digitized businesses. So if you were a highly digital business, you would, rather than having the property, payroll, and sales three-factor apportionment formula, you would just have one factor of sales. And that, the governor believed, had a constitutionality issue with singling out one type of corporate entity. And so he, along with the other reason he gave, was that he didn't want to do one-off revenue solutions. He wanted to have an entire fiscal plan. And so for those reasons, he vetoed SB 113. But he did see the value. And I believe in his in the letter that he wrote with his veto, he mentioned that there were parts of 113 that he liked that he might propose in a future bill. And that shows up here in this bill.
Great. Thank you very much. I just want to also recognize that we have in the room with us Representative Colombe. Thank you so very much for joining us. And going to the lineup I have here, I've got Representative Hannon, Galvin, Bynum, and Stapp. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Mr. Spanos, first I've got a question on our current income tax on slide 21 and the apportionment between non-petroleum and petroleum. And I'm just trying to understand. So our non-petroleum corporations that are paying based on Water's Edge on property, payroll, and sales, and I, you know, in my district, we got a lot of, say, cruise ship corporation. I assume they're paying taxes, but they have very little property, and they may have no sales because you bought that from Disney in Florida before you came here. So is that tax that they're paying only on the payroll while they're in literally Alaskan waters and limited to that?
Director Spanos?
I'm going to punt that one over to my corporate income tax manager because it's been a long time since I've audited corporate income taxes. Do we have Mike Williams on the line?
I don't see Mike Williams on the line. Mr. Williams, are you on the line? I don't believe so.
So I will attempt to answer it. The generally, and the reason I don't want to answer specific to cruise ships is that there are sometimes special regulations on certain industries, and I have to refamiliarize myself with cruise ships specifically. But in general, if a cruise ship is at a port in Alaska or within Alaska waters, so Alaska waters go 3 miles out from our shore, and so if a ship is within that 3 mile limit, they have property in Alaska. And so while they're in Alaska waters, they would count that property in the numerator. They would also count the payroll that they have in Alaska while they're in those three-mile limit. So that is in the entire course of the cruise. They would be every time they leave, it's now outside, and when they come in, it's in the numerator.
Follow up? Would I speculate that if we put them into the same kind of apportionment as we do petroleum companies and said, based on your worldwide activity, but your sales, property, and production that's happening in Alaska, that we would increase our revenue from that?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, off the top of my head, I would think that by making them worldwide, we would likely dilute the denominator, and it would create a less tax that they would be paying in Alaska.
Okay. And then I have a question off of slide 25.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. So, Mr. Spanos, on the fourth bullet, decrease taxes under the proposal, companies with a physical presence in Alaska but few Alaska customers. So the only ones I can think of is, say, a fish processor who is most of the commercially processed fish in Alaska is probably not sold in Alaska. It's sold somewhere else. Can you help me with other examples of industry where the physical presence is in Alaska, but largely the product's not being delivered in Alaska for sales?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's a good question. As I was thinking through that myself, I believe there are some alcohol producers that do a lot of shipping outside of Alaska. Fish is a good example. Not all of our fishing industry is C corporations, so they might not be a tax base anyway, and even some of those alcohol producers may not be C corporations. But this was more of a general point to be made, what other states are seeing. In Alaska, we don't have a lot of manufacturing that's being shipped outside, but we just wanted to point out that would be true in the case that a C corporation were doing that.
Okay. So, follow-up. I would be interested in seeing, based on our actual revenue productions, where we think we would have a decreased tax take under the bill as proposed. If we're asserting that we're going to have decreased revenue, I want to really understand where we're going to lose revenue and in evaluation of that policy. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Brief ideas. Okay, House Finance back on record at 1:56 p.m., and we've got Representative Galvin next in line. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I have three distinctly different questions, if I may, and there should be very short answers. Starting with the first one, and that is, I'm going to draw your attention to where it's at, slide 25, revenue impact estimated, and this is based on the new what you called, it's not called commerce anymore, something
market-based
based
sourcing.
Market-based sourcing. Mm-hmm. Now, the newly titled that, market-based sourcing. That has it at $15 million, and that's substantially different and substantially lower than, I believe, what we saw in the prior legislation that was vetoed. Could you explain that? I think it's like one-third, roughly, of what was estimated by what you called the same tax, or roughly the same. So please explain that, if you would.
Director Spanos.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I'll begin and then I'll pass it off to Dan Stickle, who could probably explain it better. But the 113, we had a range in that bill, but we didn't specify what part of that range applied to the market-based sourcing as opposed to the highly digitized business, and it was roughly one-third. Do you have anything to add to that, Dan?
Sure. Dan Stickle, Chief Economist for the record, to represent Galvin through the chair. Just to kind of put a finer point on what Acting Director Spanos stated. So in the Senate Bill 113, we had a range for the total revenue impact from about $45 million, or about $25 million, to about $65 million, and then the total revenue, the midpoint of that was $45 million, and about one-third of that was market-based sourcing, and about two-thirds of that was the highly digitized component. And so this $15 million is just the market-based sourcing component.
Thank you. I do have another question, if I may. Another slide in here is slide 26. It refers to 2031 being the zero tax effective date. And my question around that is, what is our expected net loss in revenue in 2031, if you have an estimate on that? I didn't see that in here.
Sure. To Representative Galvin through the chair, and we do have a fiscal notes section of the presentation we'd be happy to walk through that looks at that. On page 2 of the fiscal note, we break out those impacts. So for fiscal year 2031, there's a half year of impacts because the tax reduction would take place mid-year. And that estimate for fiscal 2031 is $145 million for non-petroleum and $115 million for the oil and gas corporate income tax. Then in fiscal year 2032, which is the first full year of the zero tax rate, the revenue change is estimated at $295 million for non-petroleum corporations and $245 million for petroleum corporations. Both of those are based on our fall 2025 revenue forecast.
Thank you. So a grand total of 540-ish million net loss in corporate tax. Is that for year two?
That's
okay, thank you.
For the fiscal 32.
And this question may be more for the commissioner. I appreciate understanding these numbers, which are grand, $500 million then that we will suddenly move to the negative. And my question is, I have looked a lot at different states and corporate taxes. I appreciate that actually Alaska corporate taxes are high. And I understand that. And I just wondered if there was some consideration around modernizing our corporate taxes as opposed to eliminating them. Has there been some thought around that? Or is it just let's get rid of it?
Commissioner Earls?
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, I think a lot of things were modeled, but encouraging investment in Alaska by having those rates drop to zero is what the intent is. Again, it doesn't repeal, it just drops the rate to zero so that it can be looked at later in the future.
Follow up.
And
this is regarding corporate tax specifically. When you consider ratings and what that does on the national scale, when we're talking to Moody's and all of the other ratings folks, we know ratings matters in Alaska. We've done a fine job. Do we think that putting in statute that we're eliminating corporate income tax will be helpful to our rating?
I could take a stab at that.
Mr. Stickle?
Dan Stickle for the record to Representative Galvin through the chair. I think to answer that question, you'd really have to look in terms of the broader overall fiscal plan. And keeping in mind that the 0% tax rate is just one component of the overall fiscal plan. And I think that's what the rating agencies would be looking at.
Thank you. If I might just add a comment briefly, when we look at all of these measures, we're not, to my knowledge, installing very much certainty. This one is one piece that we had in as certainty. The other piece is because we don't know what the price of anything is going to be, there is not absolute certainty in those areas, and I just want to make sure that we're aware of that. We also never know not only the price of oil, but what the market will be, period, in terms of a demand and such in, you know, 5-10 years down the line. So I'm very deeply concerned about this piece moving away. And then the last... Nope, that's that. I think I'm going to just stop right there. Thank you very much.
Okay. I just want to let folks know that we do now have Mr. Mike Williams online. He's the corporate tax manager for the Department of Revenue, calling in from Anchorage. So just so folks know, he is online. Okay, next question goes to Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, thank you for being here. I wasn't going to get into questions about specific revenues. I know that we have a fiscal note. We can talk quite a bit about that later, I'm sure. I just wanted to kind of get into some of the conceptual things that we're bringing before us here today. One of the items that we had put on the slide talked about modernizing our tax code, specifically with C-Corps. Can you tell me briefly what you think the biggest advantage of modernizing to this system would be for our tax system, and not about the rate, but about actually modernizing the method?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, by modernizing the sourcing rules, we are able to move into a modern age. So right now, there's a lot of online purchases and online sales happening where we're not capturing any of those sales. The sales are being thrown back to the state of origin, where their cost centers are located, and other states have looked at that and determined that's not really the way the world works anymore, that the cost center is where the sales should be sourced, because really those industries are marketing to Alaskans. You see the advertisements, they're marketing their goods, they're targeting us, and they're selling to us, and the sales really should be showing up in our sales factor so that we can apply a tax against that income that they're producing from our residents.
Thank you.
And so that's how it brings it up to date.
Appreciate that. Follow-up?
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So from your perspective, are we characterizing this as modernization, or are we characterizing this as a new tax?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, it's modernizing the tax system.
Now, through the chairs, follow-up. I am in full favor of making sure we have an income tax structure that's going to drive investment in the state. What other factors are we looking at other than stable taxes? Or in this case, it goes to no taxes, but I would argue that stability is important to industry. What other factors have you considered when we're talking about trying to drive investment in the state outside of modernizing the income tax? And maybe not a big list, but just are you considering other items?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, this is the governor's proposed fiscal plan. I would have to double check with him.
Okay. Follow up?
Follow up.
Through the chair. So, but we would agree that having a low or no, based on this plan, tax in place would drive investment and want to have businesses doing business in Alaska.
Okay. Yes.
The one of the other things I found interesting is that when we were talking about this, is that our current system has a non-petroleum and a petroleum element within the corporate tax code. Is that correct?
Correct.
So under our current tax code, through the chair, under our current tax code, we are treating businesses differently based on the definitions of non-petroleum and petroleum. Is that – am I – not missing something, is
through
that?
Through the chair, okay. Representative Bynum, that's correct.
And, okay. And that's, just for the record, the prior correct answer, yes. Correct, was Director Spanos, and then this answer is Director Spanos. Just want to make sure we've got that for the record. Representative Bynum?
Thank you. Through the chair, so a few moments ago when you were giving a answering Co-Chair Foster's answer with the previous item that was under consideration that was slightly different than the item that's in consideration in front of us, it indicated that it was felt that it was unconstitutional to treat one corporate tax entity based on a definition of how they do business in Alaska, that would be unconstitutional, yet we currently do that in our current corporate tax structure. So I was hoping that you might want to clarify for me so I have a better understanding of how we're currently treating entities differently and still maintaining constitutionality.
Director Spanos.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, that's a great question. When I was mentioning earlier that the reasons for the governor veto, I was repeating what the governor had put in his letter on that veto, but not being from I'm not an attorney, so I can't really speak to why the legal analysis came out the way it did for that veto, but that was the reason that he gave.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Next question goes to Representative Stout.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, to wonderful revenue folks, Spanos, Commissioner, and of course, Chief Economist, Mr. Stickland. So Rep. Galvin had said earlier, when you were talking about the revenue from the fiscal note, that the fundamental difference was that you weren't capturing revenue from digitized businesses. And I want to make sure I didn't mishear that, because my understanding, market-based sources, you absolutely would capture. You're just apportioning on the three-factor, and because they don't have payroll and property here, you're only using the sales factor. Through the chair, is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, that's accurate. So it would capture sales from a multitude of businesses, including highly digitized businesses.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up.
Yeah, so continuing on this kind of line of thought here through the chair, take a company like Netflix. They don't have any payroll and property here, but they sell here. So this bill currently would capture the sale, but you would only use basically one factor out of three. So it's like 33%, right? So the numerator would be 0, 0, and whatever they sell, because they don't have any payroll and property here. And to me, that's what kind of reduces the fiscal note, right? Because you're not capturing revenue like you would under a single sales factor, like we had in the other version of the bill. Is that accurate through the chair?
So through the chair, Representative Stapp, I want to start by saying I can't talk about any specific taxpayers, so I won't use any specific names. But if we're talking about a streaming service that doesn't have property and payroll in Alaska, certainly having a single sales factor, if they only have sales in Alaska, would give you a larger apportionment factor than having property and payroll dilute that by two-thirds.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, sorry about that. I will say a digital sailor without naming names in the future. Appreciate that. So, you know, my thought is, obviously I heard you guys talk in Senate Resources, the other body's Resources Committee, regarding what would happen if you used a single sales factor. And I thought that Chief Economist Stickle basically said that it would be a revenue loser. And because oil and gas is apportioned separately, what would drive that overall loss? So basically, if we're getting more revenue from basically companies that sell in here digitally that don't have property and payroll, we're getting less revenue from companies that do have property and payroll, but that's excluding oil and gas. What exactly are we talking about through the chair?
Mr. Stickle?
Sure. For the record, Dan Stickle, to Representative Stapp through the chair. So when we're looking at just absent the market-based sourcing piece of things, we're looking at the potential for a proposal to go from the current three-factor apportionment factor to a single sales factor. There's a variety of winners and losers among industries. The sector that would have the biggest tax increase under a single sales factor would be these outside companies that are shipping their goods and services into the state, the highly digitized technology companies. The industry that would see the biggest decrease by far is the mining industry. They're a major portion of our corporate income tax. They have a lot of property and payroll in the state, and most of their sales are taking place out of state. So they would see a pretty significant tax reduction if we switch to a single sales factor.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair, through the chair. Yeah, that makes sense. So I'll probably just shift gears here in a little bit rather than kind of keep technical hammering stuff. So there's a lot of special apportionment rules that are currently in state administrative code that are not at state statute. So I was always kind of curious on this bill we heard last year from different unnamed companies that have kind of those special apportionments and air transportation, water transportation, that type of stuff, that by updating these definitions that we could potentially be overriding their special apportionments in administrative code. And I just want to see if you thought that was accurate or inaccurate through the chair.
Mr. Tax Director, or Director.
So, Mr. Chair, now that I have my lifeline available, I think I'd like to call on Mike, if I could.
Mr. Mike Williams, if you're online, can you put yourself on the record?
Yes, for the record, Michael Williams, Corporate Tax Manager for the Department of Revenue. Through the chair to Representative Stapp on the question, the purpose of special apportionment regulations are to identify and recognize that not all industries operate under the same umbrella of what might be the framework in statute. And so these industry regs are to help clarify definitions and rules, because finance companies are different than air transportation companies, are different than cruise ship companies. And so And they don't always fall under the standard umbrella of property, payroll, and sales in how they do business. And to try and codify that in statute would certainly is your prerogative, but it would make things difficult in future should we need to address specific industry issues. And that's the whole point of having the industry regulations is to help those industries where the standard umbrella or framework doesn't quite fit how they do business.
Yeah, fault, Ms. Kocher.
Representative Staff?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that answer. It's not the question that I asked, though. I understand why you have special apportionments in administrative code. Obviously, like, you can't define, like, certain types of, like, wheeled vehicles and stuff, you know, like, in statute. It makes sense to me. But what I was asking is, does this bill, because it changes language regarding, it updates the definitions in the multi-state compact, and we have these kind of special apportionments in administrative code, does changing the statutes in the bill inadvertently kind of overwrite those things that we have in administrative code, because statute is higher than administrative code? I'm just curious if the bill does that maybe inadvertently through the chair.
Mr. Williams?
Yes. Well, through the chair to Representative Staff, again, Michael Williams, the fiscal note in the bill does contemplate that the department will issue regulations because there's a lot of heavy lift to the framework to flesh out how market-based sourcing works in application, and it would be difficult to do that all by statute, quite honestly, but there are regulations to update for market-based sourcing, and certainly, yes, we would have to update some of the industry regulations to conform with market-based sourcing.
Okay. I just got one more on this, Co-Chair, if I could.
Representative Staff?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. Through the Chair, just regarding... overall, if you were to use a single sales factor, obviously you'd have to do something. We heard the answer regarding, mining industry, for example, Alaska. Are you incentivizing companies to have property and payroll in Alaska by just using a gross receipt factor, or are you not if you choose to not incorporate those in the numerator through the chair?
Director,
anyone.
So through the chair, Representative Stapp, I'll take a stab at that. The intent that most states that went to a single sales factor or either double or triple weighted their sales factor was to incentivize property and payroll coming to their state.
And last fault, Mr. Kocher.
Representative Stapp?
This is more, theatrical, but do we want people to have property and payroll in the state through the chair? You don't got to answer that. I'm sure we do.
I appreciate you stating that it was theatrical. The governor certainly does want that, yes.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Next question, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair. Representative Stapp had briefly mentioned regulations, and I was just curious, outside of what we currently have in front of us today, if the governor's administrative order to reduce regulations would have an impact on our current tax structure, at least from a regulatory perspective.
Director Espanos?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. So if I understand the question you're asking, does it have a cost to administer regulations?
Through the chair, Bynum. Not a cost to administer, but will it have an impact overall? As Representative Stapp had indicated, that there's regulatory pieces that are not specifically in law, and through this administrative order, we're trying to figure out how to streamline and make things easier for our businesses and our communities to be able to do things. And I'm just wanting to know if that administrative order will have any specific impacts on our taxpayers per se.
Director Spanos.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I don't feel prepared to speak to the administrative order.
All right, we can talk about that another time. As a quick follow-up question.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. When we look at this, there's 10 brackets, basically one being a zero bracket in the current tax code. Was there a consideration to evaluate complexity? I guess because there's 9 brackets that companies are having to consider as they go through this to simplify the overall brackets in the income tax structure? Was that something that was of consideration as we went through this process of modernizing our tax code?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, as the commissioner stated earlier, there was a lot of modeling done. Different options were looked at. I will speak from an administrative standpoint. In preparing a tax return, having the brackets does not complicate the return. You put in your income, and the software puts it into the brackets for you.
Through the chair, I guess a snarky remark is that I think accountants love complicated tax codes, mm-hmm. but I'm an engineer, and so we like numbers too. As a quick follow-up question about stability of corporate income taxes, Mr. Chair?
Representative Bynum.
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So one of the things that we talked about earlier was to make sure that we have stable tax structure in place. Obviously, we don't like the idea that we're one of the highest in the country. I think that definitely impedes having companies want to be here. But I think instability also creates some concern for companies to want to come here, establish here, and provide jobs here. So when we look at the overall plan that's in front of us, one of the things that seems evident to me is we talked about putting in the new modernized structure, how there's advantages to Alaska businesses. We want to try to drive those businesses to come here. Yet then what we do is we then, in the future, we take the tax rate to zero. So all of those businesses that aren't inclined to come here or do business here because of a modernized structure, the incentive to me seems like that the incentive goes away, because the tax will go to zero, which they're paying now. They're not paying anything. So I was just hoping to try to get a better idea of how do we anticipate having some stability to encourage those companies to come here when in the future we're just going to put the rate to zero anyway.
So through
the chair, Representative Bynum, I believe the intent of having going to the market-based sourcing approach is to raise revenue in this interim period. The governor feels that there's several years where we need to close a fiscal gap, and then he anticipates new revenue coming online, and that the corporate income tax could go away as part of that.
Mm-hmm. And one follow-up, and then I'll be done. So, again, with the stability issue, when we look further out into the fiscals on this, we're going to see that we have a bunch of revenue that's going to come in immediately. Won't get into how we decide we want to spend that revenue. But then we will see that revenue is going to go away. And then we see a deficit that appears in the budget. And I think from a lawmaker perspective, we have then some really tough decisions that we're going to have to make on how to figure out how to make that gap. And so with the corporate rate going to zero and having a large deficit out there in the future, there's very likely conversation about whether or not this would actually happen. So I'm just concerned that when we talk about trying to make a change like this, that it does create a perception of potential instability into the future, specifically if the state's going to have a massive deficit. So I was just wondering if that was something that was taken into consideration when we are proposing to take this corporate rate to zero and how corporations might respond to that potential future instability.
Director Espanos, or...
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, I believe you all should have received the status quo and the future, like with this fiscal plan, what the impacts look like out in the future. And I don't believe that there was a massive deficit if you look at the governor's fiscal plan. But in the status quo one, there would be, because more revenues would be coming online.
Yeah, appreciate that. We'll look at that again. But my memory recalls is that there is a deficit in the future. I'll have to pull that up and we'll look at it. Thank you, Ms. Co-Chair.
I think that's definitely something that we should pay some good attention to. What I'm hoping to do today is just kind of get the basic concept out, roll this out, but I'm glad you pointed that out because that's a big crux of what we're dealing with here. And so when we come back, then we can maybe have that up on the screen and walk through those scenarios. So with that, any further questions, Representative Bynum?
No, thank you.
Okay. Representative Galvin, and then Moore.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And kind of following some of the same train of thought, I know that 2031 comes around. We're looking at about $500 million from that will be shut off from us. And we're looking at a $15 million so far in what we might still be getting in commerce, perhaps. $15 million, about $500 million, pretty big difference. And sales tax also is planning to go away. And so I just want to call that out as well. And I wanted to ask you if, well, first I'm going to make a statement that I've seen previous 10-year forecasts and I think the governor has to come up with a 10-year plan every year. And in those, they do not include anything related to inflationary costs or spend. So just want to make sure that we're aware of that, that that might be part of why you're not seeing a big deficit, because we can't consider that we are not going to be having any changes in terms of the costs of making sure that our roads are safe, our schools are whole. We've got a couple billion dollars there to catch up on just with regard to deferred maintenance everywhere, public safety, et cetera. I mean, as much as we want to incentivize businesses coming here, I can promise you from what I know from my kids, they don't want to come up here because they don't want to have their kids in our schools. They don't feel great about our roads. There's a lot of concerns right now. And so I just want to make sure that we're being really wise as a committee, thinking through what would inflationary costs look like down the road, not just, it's not, you know, always so simple. And I know our economists here at the table understand that well, but I think that it should be part of the governor's outlook for the next, for 10 years down. My question specifically is, was there research done before coming up with this cutting off the corporate income tax to know that we will be capturing a certain amount of dollars because of new business coming into Alaska? I mean, dollars that the state of Alaska can use to deliver these services. So it's not just into the economy, but into our state revenue so that we can pay for these other things, because otherwise we're not going to get these businesses to come and stay. So I wondered if, I know low price of energy matters and I know no income tax or corporate income tax matters, but did we find out from doing some sort of market research what that this would drive people here and how many and what that multiplier effect would be for us?
Mr. Stickle.
Sure, Dan Stickle for the record to represent Galvin through the chair. So we haven't modeled specifically the company behavior impact to a reduction in corporate income tax. I think we heard from some of the analysis that ICER has done that there would be a behavioral impact over time as you have a better investment climate that companies would choose to do business here. Specific to the fiscal plan, and again, we're happy to now or at some other time to go into more detail on that, and we can pull OMB up to help provide some information there. But what was really being looked at there is that there is a potential for significant additional revenues to the state in the 2030s at some point, and we're in kind of a low revenue picture now. So we have two major new oil developments coming online, the Pikka Field and the Willow Field. Those initially will come online eligible for certain new production tax benefits, but once we get into the 2030s, we're anticipating additional revenue from those fields as well as other new developments. Layered on top of that is optimism around the Alaska natural gas pipeline, and that is a significant element of the fiscal plan as well.
One final comment then, if I may.
Galvin.
Thank you. I appreciate our optimism around the 2030s. And I'm also going to say that with the many buildings in disrepair, the many schools in disrepair, and all of the teachers we are losing, it's going to be pretty hard to attract any families to want to come up and work here and stay here. They may come up for 2 weeks out of the month. But if we don't start really thinking through, I think, how we as a finance committee can look at the whole picture, we're missing the beat. And I'm seeing it already in my own children. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see here. We'll go to the next question, and then after that we're going to move over to the next section, which is the oil and gas tax section. And that will give us an hour to spend on that to at least get the basic concepts out. So with that, Representative Moore.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I'll be quick since we've spent a lot of time on this. Thank you guys for being here and bringing some clarity to this portion of the bill. I appreciate it. My question kind of goes along the route of just in wrapping this up. Has the administration or the department thought about some alternative ways to maintain corporate participation in revenue rather than shifting this to Alaskans?
Through the chair, Representative Moore, if I understand your question, this specific bill it takes the rate to zero for the corporate income tax, but it implements a sales tax. So you're talking about shifting that tax burden over from corporations to residents.
Yes.
So I will mention that one of the reasons that Governor chose a sales tax as the broad-based component of his bill was because the ICER study determined that it would generate more revenue from non-residents than other broad-based taxes. And so while the burden will be on residents, more of the burden, especially with the seasonal rate adjustment, would be shifted to non-residents, which most states hope to capture, rather have someone else pay the tax. But the C corporation going to zero, the governor feels strongly that the investment potential is greater outweighs the revenue having to come from both residents and non-residents.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So just to be clear, this is the only – there is no other alternative options that you guys have looked into, the department or the administration, for any other ways to not shift complete – responsibility on Alaskans with this eliminating the income. The corporate tax.
Director Spanos,
through the chair, Representative Moore. Thanks for the question. I would say we have modeled a lot of options. Like I would say, all the ones that we could think of, and did put those before the governor. And this is the package the governor chose.
And through the chair, this is the option that you felt was best.
Through the chair, Representative Moore, this is the option the governor felt was best.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and move right on into the next section here. So with that, Director Spanos, are you leading us off here?
I will lead off by passing it over to Chief Economist Dan Stickle.
Okay, perfect. Mr. Stickle.
All right. Again, Dan Stickle for the record. So I get to talk about oil taxes, which is my favorite thing. I'm going to start off with slide 28. Before we get into the details of the tax proposal, just a little bit of background as a refresher for the folks watching at home. So the state, prior to 2006, we had a gross profits tax on oil. It was known as the economic limit factor. That was a 12 to 15% gross tax rate adjusted downward by an economic limit factor that accounted for the profitability of different fields. The average effective gross tax at the end of the ELF period was in the 7% range. And then in 2026, we switched to a net profits-based tax with the petroleum profits tax. That was revised again just the next year in 2007 with the Alaska Clear and Equitable Share, or ACES, package. And then the current tax regime, Senate Bill 21, has been in place since 2013. Slide 29 shows some of the key elements of the Senate Bill 21 tax system. So we have a production tax rate of 35% of production tax value. That's our definition of net profits. There is a minimum tax floor of 4% of gross value based on the value of North Slope oil. And then there's credits based on oil production. There's a $5 per taxable barrel credit for qualifying new oil production and up to $8 per taxable barrel credit for other oil, the so-called legacy oil production. And then finally, an incentive known as the gross value reduction that reduces the tax impact of new fields for the first several years of production. Slide 30 is kind of a high-level overview of how the North Slope oil production tax is calculated. So we start with our gross value at point of production. That's our total value of the oil after subtracting royalties and transportation costs. Then there's kind of a side-by-side calculation that's done. We have a production tax value. That's our net profits calculation that subtracts operating and capital costs at the fields from the gross value. That's where the 35% tax rate gets applied, is to that production tax value. And then on the other hand, there's the 4% of gross value minimum tax floor. The company takes a higher of that net profits tax or the gross minimum tax to determine their tax before credits. And then that's where tax credits come in place. If a company uses sliding scale credits for the legacy oil, the non-gross value reduction eligible oil, this is the $0 to $8 sliding scale credit, then there's a hard floor, and they cannot pay anything less than that 4% minimum tax no matter what. However, there is a nuance in the tax code. If the company chooses not to use any of those sliding scale credits, it's a soft floor, and the company can use the $5 per taxable barrel credit for the gross value reduction eligible fields to go below the minimum tax floor. This is relevant under the fall 2025 revenue forecast. We are expecting most companies to pay at or close to the minimum tax floor throughout the 10-year time horizon of the revenue forecast. Some companies are expected to be paying below the minimum tax floor using those GVR-eligible tax credits. And this is really just a function of the price and cost environment that we're in. We're in a relatively modest price environment, and there's been significant cost inflation and operating costs on the slope, as well as significant capital expenditures that are taking place. So what changes in this bill on slide 31? That's fairly simple. The bill would increase that minimum tax floor from the current 4% up to 6% for 5 years from calendar year 2027 through calendar year 2031. And then the minimum tax floor would revert to the current 4% starting in 2032. There is a provision for a potential earlier reversion if oil into the TAPS pipeline averages more than 650,000 barrels per day for a calendar year, then the next calendar year the floor would revert early. In our current forecast, we expect that 650,000 barrel threshold to be reached after the floor would revert anyways, but there is a potential for some tax benefit if companies were to meet that target earlier. And then finally, on slide 32, the bill would create a new 15-cent per taxable barrel fee on all oil produced in the state. That would be effective with fiscal year 2027. The fee is based on the current nickel per barrel hazardous release surcharge, so it would be an addition to the production tax when the producer pays their production tax. No tax credits could be used to offset that. And the proceeds of this fee would be used to provide a sustainable and permanent funding source for maintenance costs along the Alyeska pipeline corridor. So these are not costs directly related to the pipeline itself, but related to supporting that pipeline, Dalton Highway infrastructure and maintenance, for example.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stickle. I have sat through a lot of oil presentations, and it's always very difficult or complex. And so I hats off to you for being able to keep this to five slides and hitting the high points. I think it's always good to, you know, kind of get the main point out there, and then we can fill the details in afterwards, as opposed to, you know, being hit with a lot of information and then trying to wrap it all together. So thank you for that. We do have a question from Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair. Mr. Stickle, the 4 to 6%
jump would in the case of Pica and Willow, would generally not materialize fully because that's GVR oil. Is that right? In other words, the 6% would be penetrated, essentially.
Mr. Stickle?
Representative Josephson, through the chair. So in the case of a new entrant developing a field like Pica, that new entrant would be subject to the minimum tax floor, but then would be able to use the $5 per taxable barrel credit to go below the floor. It would be a soft floor. It would raise the value before the application of those credits. You could have a situation where that producer would be paying no tax after credits before or after the 4-6 percent floor. The raising the floor would impact, you know, at what price they would end up paying a tax.
Okay. Okay. Follow up?
Follow up.
You mentioned earlier at the close of the previous section, you talked about the governor's belief that a gas line will come and that there could be revenue from that. But there's still an allowable, there's no reform to current law which would allow for offsets of, I don't know if it's production tax value, maybe that's what it is, but essentially the costs of, for example, gas treatment on the North Slope could be offset, or let me do it this way. Production tax in legacy fields would be offset and enjoy a deduction from gas treatment in the gas field.
Mr. Stickle?
Representative Josephson, through the chair. So what I think you're getting at is we have an oil production tax and a gas production tax. Those are actually calculated separately in the tax calculation. And we actually have an entire exhaustive presentation that we're developing for the other body. We'd be happy to come back here and share all of the detailed nuance of that. The gas production tax, in a nutshell, though, is a gross tax with a tax ceiling for qualifying gas used in state. For a company that is producing both oil and gas on the slope, they can apply all of their lease expenditures against the oil tax side of that calculation. And so to the extent that a company is producing both the oil and the gas and they have additional lease expenditures related to the gas that would otherwise be allowable lease expenditures, those could offset their oil tax calculation.
Follow up?
We know that the producers are knowable, certainly the legacy producers. Those would be it's their gas that would be produced, subject to the lease terms, of course, and our royalty share and all the rest. So we know that they're producers of oil. So what you've just described without some alteration in course is predictable? In other words, production of a Alaska AKLNG Glenfarne line could very likely result in reduction in production tax for the state.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, there's a lot of complexity in the tax code, and depending on the specific tax situation of the individual producer and prices, the production tax impact could be a positive, it could be a neutral, it could be a negative.
For the record, that was Mr. Stickle. Representative Josephson?
No, based on that answer, it's certainly worth studying so that we know what we're getting into. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. In the lineup, I have Representative Stapp, Hannon, and Tomaszewski. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Well, I hope we would not want to not have a gas line just because we got a little less government take in the event they built one. That would be kind of sad. But I do think that I have some kind of thoughts on this policy, Co-Chair. So, like, there's going to be probably four or five quick questions, if that's permissible. Thank
sure.
you. Through the chair. How many changes in tax structure, you had that on the previous slide, have we kind of monkeyed around with this stuff since 2006 through the chair? I count seven. Are there any more than that?
Mr. Stickle?
Representative Stapp, through the chair. So those are the major changes to production tax. There's been other changes, and some of these have been tax increases. Some of them have been tax decreases. There's been numerous modifications to the fiscal system over the time.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
Can you do you have like a number on that? And how would that compare to like tax policies in other jurisdictions through the chair?
Representative Stapp, through the chair, not prepared to speak to the other jurisdictions right now.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thanks. You probably the same answer through this, through Chief Economist Stickle, but how does our total government take on the industry compared to other tax regimes? Same answer.
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Stapp, through the chair, the last time we looked at that, it's been several years. We were kind of within the range of a peer group. That's not something that we've looked at recently.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
That's okay. I'm going somewhere, I promise. So the reason I asked the question is because I'm going back to slide 4 in this presentation, and it says, to make the tax climate more competitive for business investment, all right? And if we haven't looked at tax changes in other other jurisdictions, and we haven't looked at tax changes or like what our total government take is in other jurisdictions, please tell me we've at least looked at like what type of impact on potential new fields that this policy would have in the event that we increased our total government take through the chair.
Mr. Stickle?
Representative Stapp, through the chair. So yes, we have an extensive appendix that we've prepared that looks at impacts on government take and some other metrics, and we're also prepared to deliver full field economic modeling if that would be to the wishes of the committee.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp?
Yeah, through the chair. I mean, that would be fascinating for me to sit through. But I'm just curious on the simplicity of that, since you've already done it. How many fields would be probably less economical in new production if we were to do this through the chair?
Mr. Stickle?
Representative Stapp, through the chair. So, again, it's a nuanced answer. So in terms of increasing the minimum tax floor, that would have an increased tax on some fields and producers. It would have no negligible impact on other fields and producers. So it really depends on the specific field and the economics. But directionally, it's either going to be neutral or a slight disincentive.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
Let me go a specific example then. We'll just ask that. So we're having Pica and Willow, right? Both of them are going to be some sort of GVR field. You know, these companies, they went to like final investment decision and they're putting all their capital in and they haven't even gotten a draw of oil out of these wells yet. And we're going to tell them that we're going to change kind of a fundamental piece in that economics. So what would this policy have done to those two fields through the chair?
Sure.
Mr. Stickle?
Representative Stapp, through the chair. So speaking specifically to the minimum tax floor increase from 4% to 6%, we did look at this based on we have a life cycle modeling of both fields that we've put out based on entirely on public information. There's some white papers that we've released on that. Looking at the PICA field through that analysis, it would have essentially no impact as the reversion, the PICA field under that analysis would be paying basically the zero tax while the 6% floor was in place. They'd be able to use those per taxable barrel credits to pierce the floor. It would be a soft floor. And then the increase to the 6% floor, that would revert back to the 4% once that field graduated from their GVR eligibility. And then the Willow field would be under that GVR eligibility also until the reversion to the 4% would happen before they graduated from the GVR eligibility as well. So not a significant impact on either of those as long as the repeal happens as proposed by the governor. back to the 4%.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Staff.
Yeah, regarding the repeal, in Section 25 of the bill, it's page 50, lines 5 and 6, when we're looking at the 6%, I don't see anything there that actually repeals or reverses the section. And it could be wrong, but I'm just reading through that, so I don't know. And that would be after Jan 127, through the Chair.
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Sapp through the Chair, so have to...
We can do that later,
back to you on the exact language, but that is the intent of the language, is that the 6% is a temporary increase for 5 calendar years and then back to the 4% in 2032.
And last fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Staff.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the Chair. How does doing this make us more competitive for businesses?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Staff through the Chair. So the governor's intention is that the overall fiscal plan creates a more sustainable fiscal future for the state, and then the minimum tax floor increase is transient, while the accompanying corporate income tax piece is permanent. And so when you're looking out over the long term, the government take is lower under this plan than it would be otherwise.
I have one more follow-up. I lied, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Staff.
Yeah, thank you. I'll be done this time. What comes first, the tax increase or the tax decrease, through the Chair?
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Staff, through the Chair, the tax increase.
Thank you.
Okay, next up I've got Representative Hannon and then Tomaszewski. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the Chair. I think it's Mr. Stickle because he's the oil and gas production tax guy. So on page 32, the new permanent fee of 15 cents per taxable barrel, I want to make sure that I understand it would be placed in the order of operations before gross value at point of production, correct?
Mr. Stickle?
Representative Hannon through the Chair, it actually comes at the end of the order of operations. So this fee would be the way the fee would be levied in the tax code is as a surcharge when the producer pays their production tax. So at the end of the entire calculation, they pay us an additional 15 cents per taxable barrel and cannot use any tax credits or deductions to offset that.
Okay, so now you anticipated my second and third question in that. I wanted to make sure it wouldn't be coming out of revenue that should be coming in the state. So it's coming at the end of the production. That's good. If it were to go into place in FY27, how much revenue is it anticipated that it would start generating next year?
Mr. Stickle?
Representative Hannon through the Chair, and again, we have a fiscal note section that provides all of these numbers. We're estimating $25 million in fiscal year 27 for the new infrastructure fee.
And then follow-up?
Follow-up.
We're also creating a new revenue fund, the Pipeline Infrastructure Fund, with this. And you delineated it could be used for Dalton Highway, pipeline maintenance. The gas line, though, wouldn't be paying into this, right? This is just an oil tax per barrel, or would eventually gas be paying into this in the same fee?
Mr. Stickle?
Representative Hannon through the Chair. So the fee is per taxable barrel of oil in the state.
Correct. Okay. Follow-up?
Representative Hannon?
So that $25 million starting in FY27... I mean, we know that there's a lot of money that we spend on Dalton Highway maintenance. We know that the pipeline has a lot of costs that probably should be invested in. We've got a lot of maintenance costs along that corridor. But another project will substantially benefit from that investment in that corridor, but not have to participate in any taxation generating the maintenance of that corridor as this is drafted.
Representative Hannon through the Chair. So the fee would be generated directly from the oil production. The anticipation is that the primary suppliers of gas to the AKLNG project are almost certainly going to be the same companies that are also producing that oil.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I've got Representative Tomaszewski and then Representative Galvin. Representative Tomaszewski.
Asked and answered. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Representative Galvin?
Thanks. Just a quick question on the Dalton Highway maintenance. Do you know roughly what historically we've been putting in to maintain that highway? And I know we haven't maintained it to the degree we should, but if we could just have a sense of that, what the so I want to know how $25 million is going to compare to what the need is.
Representative Galvin, through the chair, I don't have that information at my fingertips. Be happy to work with our partner agencies to get that.
Thanks. Okay. Do you have any further questions? Are we prepared to speak to the fiscal notes, or would you like to come back at another time? And I realize that that's once we start down that road, I think that's when you start getting the modeling and everything, and I don't know if you'd like to do that in one fell swoop or if you'd like to maybe start now.
Mr. Chair, Santos? It's entirely up to you. We're prepared to at the will of the committee, whether you want us to get into that now. It is because it is a fairly large bill. It's a fairly lengthy fiscal note as well, several pages, or I think it's four pages. Most of our fiscal notes are 1 to 2 pages, so it's a little bit lengthy, but I think we have it condensed down to 4 or 5 slides.
I think it could there could be a lot of questions. I'll take a brief at ease. Brody. Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:55 p.m. What I think I'd like to do is what I've been trying to do is just get all, before we get into the real numbers, I wanted to get the concepts out. And one major concept that we also need to talk about is Section 35, which is the conditional language section. Maybe if we could just touch on that so that, you know, the public and everyone here kind of knows what that means. And then we could, I want to give an opportunity to Representative Bynum to, actually we'll do that first. We'll let him just speak to something that's in the fiscal notes that he wants to point out. We can maybe spend more time on it. Let's see, I think we're actually probably, we might go ahead and just start on the fiscal notes, and then if we don't get all the way through them, we can always come back to them, but at least we'll take advantage of the time that we have here. So, Representative Bynum, did you want to make your comment now? Or?
Yes, Co-Chair Foster, thank you very much, and through the chair, I was just pointing out earlier I'd asked a question talking about stability and the revenue where we would be at, and I was trying to remember where that information came from, and it came from the fiscal notes slide deck. So I was getting a little ahead of myself. And I was pointing to slide 37, which specifically talked about total UGF impact, and that's where that number came from in FY 2036. It demonstrates a $620 million negative number on that. And that's what I was actually referring to. We don't need to get into it now. I can wait, obviously, when we go through all of the fiscal notes, including the attached fiscal notes. But I just, for the record, wanted to point out that specifically where that question came from and the information that I was pointing to on that. Sorry, I did not have that readily available when the question was asked.
And if you have any comments on that now, happy to take that. Otherwise, we can move on to the next item. Mr. Stickle?
Sure. Dan Stickle, for the record, to represent Bynum through the chair. So, and we'll speak a little bit more when we get to this. When we produce the fiscal note, we're showing the estimated revenue impact of the tax changes in the bill relative to our official revenue forecast. So the official revenue forecast does have some increasing revenue into the 2030s with production from new fields, as I mentioned. And what we're showing in the fiscal note is the delta between that official revenue forecast and this bill, where you see that, yes, there's an impact of the corporate income tax elimination.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, I think we'll start with the commissioner. On the slide mentioned by my colleague from Ketchikan, I guess I treat these negative numbers in the out years as the governor not wishing, because this would be the next governor or perhaps two governors from now, the governor not wishing to burden those governors with this sort of deficit. But I know he's talked about how it's important to revisit where we are year by year. In fact, one of his provisions is the sunset potentiality of virtually every part of the government, including major departments of government. But and I sort of appreciate that, but it's not tidy, it's untidy. It's sort of you wouldn't plan a retirement with this sort of outlook. You would want something more structured, and I'm concerned about that. I can only interpret that he's not saying that governor will have to cut $620 million, or is he? Is he saying that governor will need yet again another major supply of revenue? How do I interpret that?
Commissioner Earls?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, the negative numbers that you see on the fiscal note revenue summary, that negative amount is offset by new revenues coming in from production taxes that, gas line, as Chief Stickle had spoke to.
I must say,
Representative Josephson,
Chairman Foster, I'm concerned not so much about the former but the latter. I mean, you understand that I have sort of earned a right to be very cautious because we were told about revenue from carbon injection and carbon offset featured in the ICER report, and maybe we're impatient. Maybe that's still coming, but particularly given that I 10 years ago saw billions of dollars of revenue from a gas line, and now I see half a billion if we're fortunate, I just not something I can rely on. The revenue from Pikka and Willow may be a different story, but I'm just concerned that the governor hasn't finished the job, and that if I were he, I would want to say this is swept up, this is cleaned, and I'm really leaving it, not immediately but soon, for future. Future plans for those governors without being saddled and burdened by these other numbers. Just a comment. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. If we could, Representative Gullin.
Thanks. I do have one additional question, and it refers back to our previous slide deck. I wondered if DOR is planning for per barrel surcharge revenues to be in addition to the existing Dalton maintenance funds, which are resulting in the improvements, or is it just supplanting those current appropriations?
Mr. Stickle?
Sure, Dan Stickle for the record, to Representative Galvin through the chair. So I would defer to Office of Management and Budget on what the plan is for other funds. As far as our role in Department of Revenue, we would administer the new fee, and then we would place it into the newly created designated fund.
Okay, and through the chair, if I may, could we ask for that information to get back to us, if you could work with the other department? I think it would be helpful for us to know. I know it's sliding up from 25 all to 32 throughout time based on your prediction, but I think we should have a little certainty around that to know whether it's adding in or it's removing the other one.
And
thank you.
I don't see anybody with OMB here or on the line, I assume. So with that, I'll have my staff reach out to OMB. So Thank you. With that, if you could maybe just touch on the conditional language, which is Section 35. So it's the last page of the bill, and it is page 56 of your PowerPoint presentation. And if you could just touch on that.
So the...
Mr. Spanos?
Yes, through the chair. Again, Brandon Spanos for the record. The 35 makes enactment of the bill conditional upon the passage of a version of HB 275 or similar bill. And I apologize that I don't have those bills right in front of me, but one of those is the 1% spend cap, and then there's a HB 274, or similar bill and version of HJR 30. Again, the one bill is setting a cap of 1% spend. The other bill, sunsets the different agencies for the legislature to look at, determine whether that agency should still continue into the future. And then HJR 30 doing a couple of things. It combines the funds for our permanent fund, and also would memorialize a 50% of it does three things. It caps, sets a 5% draw, and then allows for 50% of that draw to be paid as a dividend to residents.
Okay, and so just to summarize, I think it was the constitutionalizing, the 50-50 split on the one bill, the spending cap, and then the other one was the sunset of agencies, reg review, I believe is what the other name for that is. And so just so the public knows, this bill that's before us now, this omnibus bill, HB 284, if that were to be passed, it would only the conditional language requires that the other three bills or similar bills also be passed in order for this one to go into effect is my understanding. So I just wanted to make sure that folks knew that. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And just specifically, I wanted to be clear that when we talk about the conditional language that it's requiring that these bills pass, what we were just talking about. But two provisions of this require the resolution to go forward for the constitutional amendment. It's my understanding that the only provision that we have here is that would pass through the legislature, but that would not necessarily be contingent on the fact that that has to go to the vote of the people, and the people may reject that. It's possible. I'm not saying that they will. I'm just saying it's possible that they could, and I was just... You know, we haven't really talked about what the implications are of if that were to occur and what the intent of this whole bill is to do. It'd be nice to know and understand what that contingency would be, assuming that this all passed as a package and then the constitutional components failed. How would that ultimately impact the intent of what we're trying to do here with this bill?
Any takers? Commissioner Earls.
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, I'm going to have to dig into more aspects of HJR 30 and get back to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I am looking here. It looks like if we were to tackle some of the fiscal notes, it looks like maybe the first section of the fiscal notes section is only pages 34, 35, 36, 37, so only four pages. And then after that is the fiscal note on expenditures. Maybe if you could just go ahead and we'll go to a question with Representative Galvin, and then we'll just address those for the first part of the fiscal notes, and then we can come back later. So with that, Representative Galvin.
Thank you so much, Co-Chair Foster. So we heard an interesting question from Co-Chair Josephson around the revenue pieces and how we were going to recoup $620 million. And the answer was that in part this was part of a bigger puzzle to be inclusive of revenues from the gas line. And if I may, I know that's not – the gas line isn't in here, but because to me it's important that we understand the broader context, I haven't heard about any revenues from gas line. So if you have – if that's permissible, I would like to hear very briefly if you where that comes from and if you have it. Firstly, if you have it. Secondly, where you're getting that information.
And Representative Galvin, actually, I think that's a good discussion. I as you
it's a bigger
noticed,
one.
I mentioned earlier that I love starting with a big picture, trying to get some context rather than starting with a little tiny things and then working our way up. It's good to have the big picture first. And then we can certainly spend, the remainder of our time kind of addressing those bigger issues and then start kind of getting into the finer details. So with that, who'd like to Mr. Stickle?
Sure. Dan Stickle for the record, to Representative Galvin through the chair. So I can speak generally to the gas line modeling. And again, we have some information that's been provided on the fiscal plan. This omnibus tax bill is one component of the larger fiscal plan. Broadly speaking, relating to gas line modeling, we have a team of economists in Department of Revenue, as well as Department of Natural Resources. We've been working collaboratively with the Gas Line Development Corporation and the Governor's Office. We have a very sophisticated set of gas line modeling, lots of assumptions and runs that we've done there. We do have a baseline scenario that we have used for internal purposes. We haven't, to my knowledge, we haven't put that out as a public a document yet at this point. The governor's fiscal plan includes that baseline scenario around the AKLNG project and then the state revenues that would be associated with that. And those would include revenues from property tax, production tax, both on gas and potentially additional oil production that would come along with the gas line, and then royalties from both oil and gas.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. A quick follow-up. So essentially, you're not privy or you haven't been given permission yet to share details, but that you're sharing, you did get some insight to that and know. So I'm looking at slide 37. And based on what you know about mostly the missing piece here is the gas line, I already know about fields and other things. You have a lot more certainty around that because they've already started drilling. A lot of those are 10 years in advance. You kind of have a sense, I suppose, with some certainty. You still don't know the price of oil and all of that or what the demand will be. And we have a lot of uncertainty, of course, about the market and price of gas, and we haven't yet started the project. So the level of uncertainty to me seems fairly high, but I appreciate that there's been some modeling, and now you're looking at 2034. It looks like is the first time period where we really feel like, oh dear, we're seeing a pretty massive hole. Although I would also argue that with some of these other numbers that there's certainly a level of uncertainty there too, but certainly by the time of 2034, is the gas line, I haven't heard of when we know that that'll even be complete, let alone started. And so I'm really asking for a bit more, even though you can't give me precise numbers, but to understand that we see this coming into play is important.
Sure.
Mr. Stickle.
Representative Galvin through the chair. So to be clear, our official revenue forecast does not include any revenue from the gas pipeline. Mm-hmm. The convention that we have used, and this has been a longstanding convention, is that we will revisit that assumption once there's a final investment decision. Okay. So we've been very conservative on the gas line and the revenue forecast. Now, if the gas line, assuming the gas line does proceed with kind of some of the timelines that have been discussed, potential for a phase one discussion or phase one investment decision sometime this year, and then proceeding to the full gas pipeline project in our modeling, fiscal year 2034, there will be significant incremental revenue to the state from the gas line project. That'll actually start coming in early in the 2030s, and so that's where, you know, the governor felt that it was appropriate to have a phase down of some of the other tax proposals.
Well, thank you. And Co-Chair Foster, these are the sort of questions that I know we're all wrestling with, and so much uncertainty when we know some of the small communities are already worried about losing property tax revenue potentially. That's still not yet worked out either. And then we also don't know the pricing of what we were told at one point was we can do all of this without you to the state of Alaska. You do not need to put any money into the gas line. We've got this covered for all of the things that permitting's pretty much done. And I appreciate that. But that means to me also we may not get much of the take from it also. And that is all relevant in this conversation, because if there is some sense that we're going to help, we're going to get some of that as a wraparound to help fill in some of these gaps that we see here. I think that we have a lot of discussion that is part of the bigger picture. I do want to make sure that we're at the table getting our fair share for Alaskans, so that it's not something that we're at the end of the day either paying for or suffering from decisions that we didn't make that would help make sure we got that fair share to keep our lifestyle, our way of life continuing here. And so thank you for allowing this questioning, because I do think it's critical.
Thank you. I'd like to also recognize that we have with us Representative Ruffridge. Thank you for joining us. I did see Representative Jimmy, but I also thought maybe I saw... Representative Jimmy.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I just wanted to ask, have you guys followed a model like showing other states this kind of work where it shows 10 years down the road to promise... to make it more enticing to companies to come and work where you lower tax rates? Is there other states doing this as well?
Mr. Stickle or Spanos? Mr. Spanos.
Through the chair, Representative Jimmy, we, as part of the analysis for this package, we didn't specifically look at other states. However, in general, yes, we do meet with our counterparts pretty regularly and try to understand what their tax structures look like. And that's some of the information we bring back to the governor to when he's looking at different options on how to close the fiscal gap, as well as incentivize investment in Alaska. And so the governor did look at other states, specifically related to the corporate tax rate, and compared Alaska to those states. And he felt like our rate was too high. Ultimately, he decided that it was better to go all the way to zero. But there was a comparison done with the other states as far as specifically to the oil and gas. The gas pipeline is quite unique to Alaska. I don't know that a lot of other states are struggling with anything quite like that, getting gas to market. But as Mr. Stickle mentioned earlier, we haven't done an analysis of our the oil and gas for several years related to other jurisdictions.
Okay. Representative Bynum?
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And through the chair, just a really quick overview. Obviously, what we're going over here is the bill in front of us and the considerations that we have for each one of these sections. My questions, I won't speak for the other members, are specifically related to the item that is in front of me here. We have this bill is a 56-page bill. I have a 3-page scenario, a 4-page fiscal note, a 58-page slide deck that we've been going through, and three bills total plus a resolution to consider. I'm wanting to know if available to us is a report and an analysis that goes over some of the questions that we've asked. Number one, how are Alaskans that are eligible for the permanent fund dividend going to be overall impacted by this bill? Did it evaluate them by region? Number two, how are Alaskans that aren't eligible yet or not eligible at all for the permanent fund dividend going to be impacted by this bill? Number three, how are corporations that are currently operating in Alaska going to be impacted by the corporate tax structure changes? Number four, how are corporations outside of the state going to be impacted by this bill? And then ultimately, number five, what is the overall anticipation of all revenue sources going to be, and you've mentioned some of those, and how that will impact the finances of the state. So I'm really looking for an overall comprehensive report that evaluated all of those things so that we have a better understanding of the ideas that went into this. Obviously, well, first of all, does that evaluation and report exist? And if so, will it be made available to us so that we can have it in conjunction with all of this information? Help us make a more informed decision. And if one is not prepared or ready, do we intend on doing that? And then finally, I would say that, you know, it's a real challenge when we look at all of these things and trying to get them all done in this short period of time. I know that there's been many discussions over the years on this, but many of us have not been here for many years. You know, this is my second year. And I'm being presented with this fiscal plan that's being proposed as a fiscal plan. So having that background information or detailed analysis before something like this comes forward would be very helpful. So the question is there something available? And if not, will there be something forthcoming?
And I was just about to say, I think that's a great question. It's the crux of everything that we're trying to wade through, I think. And I was just about to say that might be the perfect ending point. We do have one more question, but I want to give you the opportunity to, you know, say anything you'd like to say with regard to that. But I suspect that it's probably going to take a little bit of maybe putting something together to get us maybe something in writing or come back and tell us it. But anyway, if you've got an answer, I guess. Commissioner Earls?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, I would have to defer to our economic research group on everything that's been prepared. I don't know that it's all in one document, but I believe there are many elements of five or six pieces of what you requested, but we can get back to you in writing.
Representative Bynum?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Yeah, specifically, I mean, we have a package here in front of us. And I understand that, you know, you can reach from all different data sources to come up with all kinds of different ideas, but these have all been packaged together. And so my anticipation or expectation would be is that I'd be able to evaluate what is in front of us as a full package based on detailed information that was used to put this together and the impacts of all of those areas, plus more. I mean, I didn't mention all the areas of impact, but that would be very, very helpful, not just for myself, but for the public that's also scrutinizing what's in front of us. So thank you, Co-Chair.
And I suspect you'll put something in writing, as we've seen with some of the other questions we have. I think this is, I think this is something that you could probably spend a lot of pages on trying to address. I would love to see something maybe as more of a summary initially, and then you could have a lot of backup detail, but just, you know, to kind of get to the simple answers. I realize there are no simple answers in all of this, but if we could kind of get the basics out on the table, and then whatever backup information would be needed to back up that, you know, could certainly be maybe more of an appendices type thing. But I'm open to however we want to do it. Representative Josephson, do you have a question?
Yes, and another thing at a future hearing, if you're not prepared now to respond to, is I last, when I spoke, broached the question of the the deficit in the fiscal note in the out years, 10 years from today. And the response was that we have to hope to have new resource development and therefore new revenue in the form of tax and royalty. But I've been reminded that the two 10-year plans that have issued from OMB in the last 2 to 3 months are so different because of the adjustment on spending that is hoped for in the spending cap provision of the governor's fiscal plan. So just December 11th, which was very recent, the agency operations the governor anticipated on December 11th were $5.95 billion in 2036. So that's about $6 billion in 10 years. And under the new 10-year outlook, those same funds are $5.1 billion, a difference of about $800 million. So now resource development doesn't just have to rise, it has to rise substantially to cover that deficit. And of course, it begs the question, am I saying we couldn't live within our means plus 1%? I am saying that. I think there's no evidence that that can happen, particularly given all the things that Representative Galvin talked about, all of the ongoing harm to deferred maintenance, to lack of inflation adjustment in K through 12. The list is so long. And so I need some further explanation of how additional resource development can cover that additional $800 million too in the event. I mean, is the cap he's proposing statutory or constitutional? Let's start with that.
Commissioner Earls?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, it is a statutory change.
Yeah, I would need, thank you, I just need more explanation of that. And I was hoping, Mr. Stickle, it seemed like you were about to give us, and I know they're out there, I've seen them, revenue projections from AKLNG. We had them in SB 138. Of course, they didn't materialize, so I'm not sure what their value was. But the revenue department, then Mr. Butcher and I think Ms. Rodell had slide decks showing $3 billion. About $1 billion of that was for local governments, effectively. And I it'd be great to see where we are on AKLNG. And it may seem like that's tangential from this, but I think it's seminal. I think it's part of the whole in understanding whether we should give to future legislatures and governor a burden that is projected by this governor of deficit. Thank you.
Do we have any comments? Otherwise, I'll wrap up okay. Anything further from the committee? We are at the ending point of our meeting, and very much appreciate it. I know this is a very complex issue, and there's probably a lot more work that needs to be done. I think there's a lot of questions. Appreciate your time. With that, our next scheduled meeting is tomorrow at 1:30 p.m., and at that meeting we will be hearing the introduction of House Bill 280, that is the Digital Tax Compact, as well as House Bill 289, the supplemental budget. And so if there is nothing else to come for the committee, we'll be adjourned at 3:26 p.m. Thank you.